I'm Dave Hoekstra. This is Nocturnal Journal, and we've got Otis Clay and his fine, fine band. Thanks a lot for coming down here, Otis. I've known you for many years. You shine a good light across many worlds. I mean, rhythm and blues, gospel, and soul music, and number two. Okay, can you hear him all right? Okay, all right. So, how you been, Otis?
Everything's great, Dave. Thanks so much for inviting me, man. You know, this is a new thing for us.
Me too.
That's what I mean. Yeah. You know, you and I were doing some other things over the years, and it's great to know that, you know, you retired and started working all over again.
You've been busier than you've ever been. I mean,
yeah.
You did the Soul Brothers thing with Johnny Rawls, yeah. Right? That's kind of an O.V. Wright thing. We'll talk about that in a minute. And I know you played with our friend Dave Spector on the Message in Blue thing.
Right.
You did the Falcons tune, I Found a Love. And tell us about Take Me to the River. Wednesday and Thursday, you're going to be in New York with like a live version of that. Tell us about that documentary.
Well, the Take Me to the River is the most unusual thing because it involves, it's a movie. It's a documentary.
Right.
So that's, I find myself now at film festivals, you know, which is a totally different thing. And now it's going into an educational initiative, you know. So because of the generational thing with all the different generational people that's involved in this movie, you know, some things are happening that you wouldn't think would happen. So you hear you have these soul singers, blues singers, with rappers.
Yeah, tell us the storyline of the movie. They're kind of merged together. Right?
Yeah. You know, and
William Bell, Bobby Rush. You're in it. Who all's in it?
William Bell, Bobby Rush, Mavis Staple, Booker T. Then you have a genuine, bona fide, certified actor, Terrence Howard. You know. And of course, you have the guys that made the music, the musicians, the high rhythm section, and people like that. And as well as you got the young people coming out of Stax Academy, who's playing music playing like vets, you know. So it's real interesting.
And how were they paired up? Like, who were you? I haven't seen it. So who were you paired with?
I'm paired with Lil Peanut.
Oh, okay.
You know, I'm with Lil Peanut. And he was in the movie with Ice Cube and Kevin Hart called Ride Along. Mm-hmm. But he, at about probably six, something like that, he's doing like the Ellen DeGeneres show. He's got some things on Nickelodeon. So it's a great mix, you know. We're doing some Rufus Thomas songs as well as trying to live my life without you, yeah.
Is there anything you learned from working with these young cats and stuff?
Well, yeah. You know, because you have a whole different perspective, you know, of this genre, of music, you know. And then you find that so-called hardcore rappers are saying, yes, sir, Mr. Clay, is there something you need, Mr. Clay, or how are you? You know, and you say, wait a minute, no, this is not how this is supposed to go, you know. So it's interesting.
What other film festivals? Did you go to Colorado? Did I hear that?
We just did the Sundance. You know, we just did the Sundance. We did the Rain Dance in London. We did South by Southwest, which was totally mind-blowing, you know, because you've seen the demographics of where this thing is going, you know. You got Snoop Dogg, you know what I mean, one of the biggest names in rap. So you're pulling that audience in who's getting to know, or some folks saying, okay, William Bell, which is doing
Stacks, guys,
I Forgot to Be Your Lover. Mm-hmm. And, well, William not only had the first hit, he wrote the song. You know, so you got people coming out to the concert saying, I thought there was someone else had a big hit on it not long ago, and they thought that was the original version, and now you're hearing how it was recorded back in the 60s, you know. So that is the interesting thing about this movie, the longevity of the movie, because now it's moved into the educational initiative. So now it takes on a whole nother thing.
You and I talked that we were just talking before the show. I mean, our first interview was like 1983 for the Suburban Sun-Times. You were living out in Hoffman Estates.
Yeah,
I was looking at some of those pictures today. You had all the reel-to-reel equipment and stuff.
Oh, man, yeah.
But, you know, I mean, we talked then. I wrote some of this down. I mean, back then you were telling me about your background in gospel, for listeners who may not know that. I mean, the Golden Jubilaires, the Blue Jay Singers, the Pilgrim Harmonizers and stuff. So for people who don't know about that, talk about how you came into both worlds, and you've been able to live very comfortably in all kinds of different musical worlds. I mean, you've sung country music, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, I grew up listening to all this different genre of music. I used to listen as a first, some of the first things, my first memories was of music was the Grand Ole Opry, you know, and living in Mississippi, you know, black programming was very limited, which was, okay, what is the upside? The upside was I got a chance to listen to all this different music, you know, and so I'm listening to country and western, pop of the day and the hit parade and things like that, as well as my first, the very first concert I ever saw was Muddy Waters.
Where was that at?
In Clarksdale, Mississippi.
It was in Clarksdale, yeah.
Yeah, in Clarksdale, and at a theater. You know, I didn't go there to see Muddy Waters. You know what I mean? I went there to see the Western.
See the movie.
Yeah, my brother would always take me to these. You know, hey, man, we were big on going to the movies and things like that. And so he would go out and get odd jobs and things like that. And, of course, come and get his baby brother. And we're going to the movies, man. And I'm sitting up here, and I see Muddy Waters. You know, and it has more effect now than it did then. And I'm saying the first thing I ever saw was Muddy Waters. There has to be something spiritual about that. Yeah.
And you moved, was it Muncie, Indiana first? When did you come up to the Chicago area?
Moved to Muncie, Indiana first.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Your family?
Yeah.
What'd your dad do? I don't know. I don't know if I know that. What'd your family do? Why did they come north?
Well, you know, it was a typical
work.
You know, although it was unusual being in Muncie, Indiana, but I had an older sister that lived there, you know, and so families always and friends followed certain paths, you know, in doing these things. Although my maternal grandfather and two maternal uncles lived here in Chicago, you know. So that's how I wound up Muncie, then into Chicago.
And into Chicago. And was there also a neighborhood settling thing of like Jerry Butler and Pop Staples? I know Pop Staples worked in the Stockyards and stuff. Did people go to different neighborhoods? And did you get to know different musicians as you settled in Chicago?
Well, you know, here we go with the old saying, meet me in church. That's where I met Mavis and all of them at that time, because they were doing this, their first record, which was Uncloudy Day, you know. And so you meet a lot of folks socially, you know. It wasn't just religious in church. You had the social thing, you know. And so that's how for Mavis, Perv, and what we call it, you call her Cleotha, we call her Cleety.
Cleety, right.
You know, and Yvonne.
Was there we had L.C. Cook on the show in a few last month and stuff. Was there like Sam Cooke, everybody always talks about, you know, breaking over into secular world. Did you have a conflict with that? Or was that a natural thing for you to do?
No, I didn't have a conflict with it, because my first professional gig was with the Blue Jays. I was 18 years old. And the Blue Jays were known as variety singers, which were very common back during that time, because you had a certain form of gospel or genre of music that you call Jubilee, which sounds very much like rap. So I had been exposed to the music at that time, so it was nothing, you know, I had been exposed like that.
We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back with one of your wonderful tracks. I really thank you guys for bringing the whole band in. This is really something. So we'll be right back with Otis Clay and his band.
Please, somebody take your hand.
slap some sense in me. Open my eyes, cause I'm too blind to see. I've got this woman, and she's messing my mind around. She knows that I love her, but still she's trying to put me down. You know I'm just a fool, someone she can use. But I can't help myself, oh no, I can't help myself, ooh. Now listen, baby. Oh, I know I'm just your fool, but I love, and for you I'll break every rule. Now I've broken heart before, if you want to love me, but now I fell in love with you, place no one above you, and Lord knows I love you, always thinking of you, but I can't help myself, I can't help myself. Oh no, please don't look down on me, because I'm weak. When you're in love, it's easy to be. I know I'm being abused, misused and confused, but that's how it is when you're in love. That's how it is. I know that's how it is. Keep on holding on, you keep on, keep on, you just keep on, keep on holding on now, you see. I know I'm being abused, misused and confused, but that's how it is. Keep on holding on, you keep on being abused, but that's how it is when you're in love. Oh yeah, keep on, I know you don't love me, come on, oh.
Wow, thank you. That was awesome. Thanks. That was. Now tell us about that track. It's been at our sponsor, Dusty Groove. I've been buying the wonderful stuff. Tell us about one. That was a wonderful track.
That was a wonderful track. That was my first national hit, 1967. But I was young. I was real young at that time, Dave. So I don't want 1967 to scare you.
Yeah. And just we're going to have to take another break for the news. But where was I like the anthropological stuff. Where was that at? It was on Record Row. I think
1827 South Michigan Avenue at the wonderful studio, which was kind of unusual for a record company, and especially a small record company, to have its own studio. But it was really great because it gave us a chance to work out material and what have you.
House band, I mean, Mighty Joe Young, I mean, am I right? Wow. Mighty Joe Young, Cash McCall, yeah. I mean, guitarist.
Well, Cash McCall wrote the song.
Yeah,
Cash
right.
McCall,
yeah.
And Monk Hagan. And although at that time when we released that, they had moved over to Chess. Cash and Monk Hagan was writers and producing at Chess at that time.
Willie Henderson? Was he on set?
Oh, yeah. Willie was coming out of the service at that time, you know, because Willie was in Vietnam, and he came in. Of course, he was that wonderful. They were part of that Cash Registers, or with Alvin Cash in the Registers.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, we're going to take a break for the news. We're going to come back, talk a little O.V. Wright, and talk a little Burning Spear, talk to Max.
So don't go away, there'll be more music.
Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal. I was doing my research and I saw February 11th. It's your birthday.
Right.
So happy birthday.
Thank you so much.
From all of us.
Thanks, guys. Okay, we now that everybody know we get the gifts together, nothing expensive.
You're all fired. Cancel that.
You threw me on that one.
What are you going to do in New York for your birthday?
I'm going to go to some of the places that I went to the last time that's still there, and that the last time I played the Apollo, you know.
You were telling me during the break you did go to Sylvia's and stuff. And,
Sylvia's,
everybody goes there.
Yeah. All the great, you know, it was a lot of cooking going on down in Harlem, man. Yeah. Always.
Yeah, and what'd you have there? What was the first thing you had there? You were telling me at the break.
Well, you know, I had my first bean pie.
Yeah.
Damn.
In Harlem.
Yeah.
You know, but you have, like, all these religious organizations and things down there, man, and it seemed like everybody had a restaurant, you know. But then you had all the great, famous preachers that you know, like people like Sweet Daddy Grace, and
all right,
and all those kind of things was going on. So yeah, I started going to Harlem and playing the Apollo in 1964. I was with the Nightingales at that time.
Here comes the cake I baked this afternoon.
Lord, mercy.
Yeah.
Make a win. Thanks, Dan.
Happy birthday, Otis.
Happy birthday, Otis. You're the best. You've been a guiding light. I actually have forks and stuff. I'll pass it out at the break. So we got Max Brumbach. Max, you put all this together. Thanks for everything.
You're
Tell us
welcome.
About your relationship with Otis.
Well, sure. I auditioned for Otis's band back in, I think it was either late 73 or 74. And at that time, the band was called the Jaguars. James Wheeler was a guitar player. And he has just recently passed away, actually. Great James Wheeler. There was Sam, was it Burton?
Burton
on drums. And I don't remember who the bass player was. But
Johnny Howard,
okay. And then... within 6 months, we were playing with some other cats, but Wheeler and I stayed, and we did the Burning Spear on 55th and State was our home base.
Tell us about, and we've talked about that too. Tell us about the Burning Spear.
Burning Spear was this huge nightclub from the 20s that actually had been the Club DeLisa, and it had a stage that actually elevated. That was long since they didn't bother to elevate it after the big shows. But it also had murals of Count Basie, Duke Ellington, Billie Holiday on the walls that were very old and yellowed from decades of cigarette smoke. But it was a great, great old place. So we would rehearse there just about every day.
Otis, did you tell me one time, like, Robert Plant and Jimmy Page, they came in after a Zeppelin show at the Burning Spear?
Wow.
Did you get visitors like that?
Those memories become more precious as time goes by, because we were all Robert Plant and all the guys were playing Chicago Stadium, you know. And I was, at that time, you know, had a lot of social clubs, so I had been playing at the social club. So we all met after our gigs, which was early, you know, and Bobby Bland was playing at the Burning Spear. You know, and so there was a road manager, friend, what have you, at Bill Cody.
Oh, I heard it, yeah.
Who had the dances, you know. So that I met Robert Plant and Jimmy Page and all the guys there. They were following the dances around the club.
Oh, was that the Bill Coday that was the singer?
No.
Okay.
Bill Cody, yeah. Bill Coday at
Two
that time.
Cats. Okay.
Yeah. And so that's how I met, as they were passing me, you know, Bill Cody said, "Oh, this is the guy I work with. This is Otis Clay." And Robert Plant said, "Oh, I just do one of your songs," which was a song called Easier Said Than Done. You know, so that's how I met Robert Plant.
Okay.
So getting back to how I met Otis Clay, which is a lot lower down on the totem pole. I played with him for about 4 years, and we largely went on the road playing what I guess you would call the Chitlin Circuit.
No, not quite. No, wait, yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I know. It's a thing, but like, you know, we played some great clubs.
Well, we did. And we played some auditoriums. We played a couple of huge auditoriums, too. But what was nice was we also got to see a whole bunch of other people like Johnny Taylor, Joe Simon. We backed up William Bell a couple of times, which was a pleasure.
Ovie Wright.
Yeah, Ovie Wright.
I want to talk
backed
about
up Ovie
Wright.
Wright. Yeah. Ann Peebles. We backed up Ann Peebles. So I met Willie Mitchell in a club in Detroit. I mean, it was just wonderful. It was just such a great thing to be. And we actually played on the bill with Al Green, too. So we got to see all this live music. And we would cross Little Milton and Tyrone Davis and Cyril Johnson. All these cats were all on the road, and we'd be coming into one club, and one of them, Albert King, whomever, would be leaving the same club.
What knocked you out about Ovie Wright? I know you're a big fan. I know that's what the latest record is about. But what was it that got you about him, Otis?
Well, Ovie Wright was, we met in gospel. I was about 16 years old, something like that, when Ovie and I met. He was singing with the gospel, with the Sunset Travelers out of Memphis at that time. Ovie, Mark, I don't know if you knew this or not. And a lot of folks didn't, but those that knew, O.V. knew the changes to every one of his songs. Hmm. I mean, he could walk in here right now and you think you guys recorded the song because he knew how to guide the band and he knew all the changes and he could call them all.
One of the last shows I played with you was at the auditorium. Mm-hmm. And I remember I took the L because I was living in Edgewater. It's like a dream come true. There was a Hammond, so I didn't have to bring a thing. So I took the L, walked up the Congress thing, walked over to the auditorium. They let me in. I played the gig, but we backed up Ovie Wright on that gig, and everybody was on that gig. That was one of the Purvis Band's big blues extravaganza. And I mean, Bobby Bland was on it. B.B. King was on it. Ovie Wright, probably about four or five other people. So I'm in the dressing room, and Otis says, well, we're going to back up Ovie Wright on this tune and that tune. Well, I recognized one of the tunes, but the other one was like, I think it was called The Jury of Love, and I went,
Eight Men, Four Women.
Eight Men, Four Women. And I said, Ovie, how does that go? And he drew me aside over to the corner of the dressing room, and it was real quiet, and he just started singing that song. And the hair on the back of my head stood up, and I was going like, oh, my Lord. I mean, it was one of those music experiences of a lifetime. And all of a sudden, because he didn't look prepossessing, but that guy was so, so, so good. He was amazing. Yeah.
There were great shows. You were telling me the other day, there were great sideshows at the Burning Spirit. High Five Wife.
Yes. We'll never forget High Five Wife, who was a protege of Red Fox.
Yeah.
He was a 300-pound transvestite who, if you did not behave, he would grab you by the crotch and lift you 2 feet off the floor. And pretty soon, you were very polite to this cat.
Yeah.
After that, one time, or even watching it happen to somebody else. And we had a very good-looking tenor player named Fred, who was Persian in the band. Fred. And Hi-Fi be at the mic, goes, that there my husband, Fred. And oh, Fred would turn every shade of red. Oh, my God. Yeah, but there was a lot of, I think Godfrey Cambridge came down a couple of times.
Yeah.
Various cats, whoever was in town. It was kind of like very, very cool. And a couple of the comedians were hilarious. The guy that Herb Kent always had on, I can't remember the cat's name, but he did a lot of shows, too. Huge history of comedy in I mean, like
Emmanuel Arrington.
Yeah, man, that's who I was thinking. Emmanuel Arrington, hilarious. Yeah, we played some shows with him, and then we played the Burning Spear or the High Chaparral also, and then various little joints. Sometimes gymnasiums, you'd have to haul your stuff up a flight of stairs. Sometimes a real high flight of stairs. It was not easy, but we were young too, so it was easier.
I'm not going to ask you, Otis, your favorite place to play, but was there a place where you felt home, felt a real comfort zone when you were coming up? I mean, was this a place that you just knew you could do it?
There were places that were the places, you know, and we're going to play there next week. And we're talking about the Apollo Theater. You know, the Apollo, to this day, You know what I mean? I don't, you know, and I mean, it's so, it's something about the Apollo where it was always a proven ground. You know, you can't go into the, I see some of the things that happened there now, you know, but when I went in there and I started in gospel at the Apollo, because gospel held the record at the Apollo for years. It's not still holding the record because you got all these people in Harlem coming out to this gospel, these gospel shows, you know. And then I went into secular music and I'm playing the Apollo Theater. So it's one of those special places on the planet that it says a lot when you go there.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back and we're going to have some more live music. So don't go away with Nocturnal Journal.
My practice here is today. It's all the hardest thing to put them away. I drank 4 or 5 bottles of wine. I kept a glass in my hand all the time. Oh, breaking old habits was hard to do. That's the path to the changes you put me through. Trying to live my life without you, babe. It's the hardest.
Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal. That was Trying to Live My Life. Great job. Now, you know, I saw Seeger November or something. He did that song. We talked about that. Have you ever done that with him? Tell us about how did Bob Seeger find that song?
I really don't know. He and I have talked about it several times. We never actually went on tour together. So it's kind of funny now. He's got the Jay Giles Band.
Right.
And both of them recorded the tune.
Yeah.
You know, I think the Jay Giles band may have recorded it first, before Bob Seeger. But, you know, guys get together. You know, and we do it all the time. That's how you come together and discuss the fact, well, man, why don't we do, or have you heard a certain song or something like that? And so I would assume, because he always tells this story about the Eagles, you know, how they wind up doing in the long run, which is pretty much the same identical bass line. So sometime we get together and say, let's sing together, let's do a record or something like that. And we never really discussed how he came up with the tune, but he was listening to some Willie Mitchell production and came up with the song.
Yeah, how was it like to work with Willie and get that down?
I worked with the greatest producers on the planet. When you talk about Rick Hall in Muscle Shoals, and then here we come with Willie Mitchell in Memphis, right up the road from there. There's the comfort zone in being a great producer, you have to create that in order to get the best from an artist. You can't intimidate him. You know what I mean? Uh-huh. And you know, you got to realize, well, I'm with a producer that has produced more hits than you can count. Well, you have to forget that. That can't get in the way of what you're doing. And Willie Mitchell could do that. Rick Hall could do it. You know, and that's what made both of those places recording centers of the world.
Max, what did you learn from playing with Otis? What did you learn?
Well, it was, I guess you'd call it part of my schooling. I had played with a couple other soul groups, the Artistics I did some gigs with. And then in high school, I played a long time with some guys, like a singer who nobody knew about, who was basically a Curtis Mayfield kind of singer and guitar player. Played guitar like Curtis, too. So I had some schooling before Otis, but I guess playing with Otis was kind of like going to college, I imagine, for 4 years. I learned a lot. I mean, the more you play, I learned this, playing with Otis and then also playing with another guy who we did, actually, we played 7 gigs a week in Canada. And when you play 7 gigs a week, we played every night but Sunday, and we did a matinee on Saturday, because in Canada, you do 2 shows on a Saturday, an afternoon show and an evening show. So it just really helped my confidence as a player. And you come back, you take a week off, and you're still like, I suppose it's like golf or something like that, or baseball, neither of which I do. But once you're kind of in that zone, it really helps doing all that, like, woodshedding. But there's nothing like playing on jobs night after night after night to really help your playing.
You know, I talked about this years ago, and I think it's probably changed a little bit, but there were challenges for soul and rhythm and blues artists to break through on the north side, because you and I talked about how this town is so identified with the blues, and getting gigs up on the north side for a while, it was really hard. And that's changed a little bit?
Well, if you didn't have, because of people doing so-called genres of music, soul was never really, until I did it, you know, because other than that, it was, if you want to say, blues, you know. So here come this guy with backup singers, horns, you know what I mean? And that was kind of unusual. So that was what was all new at that time. So we did it for quite a few years.
Okay, we're going to take a break for the news. We'll have one more song, so don't go away, and then we're going to go down to Cuba. You guys going to hang around and play a little Latin music?
All right.
All right. So thanks a lot. We'll be back with Nocturnal General after this.
Love and happiness, something that will make you do wrong, make you do right. Someone's on the phone, 3 o'clock in the morning, she's talking about how she can make it right. Happiness is when you really feel good about somebody. Ain't nothing wrong, no, with being in love with someone, yeah. Each other.
away with victory. Yeah.
That's the most fun I've had on this show. So thank you. Otis Clay on vocals, Max Brumbach on keyboards, Chris Hambone Cameron on keyboards, Andre Howard on electric bass, Ricky Nelson on drums, John Brumbach on tenor sax, Jeff Gilmore on tenor sax, Vince Salerno on baritone sax, and Larry Bowen on trumpet.